This is
Wow!
What a week.
What a week. Celebrity guest.
Celebrity guest.
Welcome to Wow, What a Week. Now, some say that our next guest and I have a number of similarities. We've gotten large crowds of diverse people up on their feet. We were both with well-known outfits before being let go of. We had some major disagreements with management, specifically senior female management. And after much nagging to do it, we both started our own ventures to do our thing. Here on my venture to talk about his, please give a warm welcome to the leader of Build One South Africa, Bosa, because Kiboza. Make some noise for Musi Maimane. Awuthegata Thabile.
Yes, media.
How are you doing, dog?
Ah, my man, so good to see you, and I'm
sorry
so
about the mic is in your way.
So good to see you, and I'm a big fan, and now I can see why I'm a fan, because we share so many common
exactly. We get fired by women. We must start our own thing. We're both Kaizer Chiefs fans.
Oh.
In fact, Kaizer Chiefs might or might not be responsible for the colors of your party.
You know. I was, hey man, hey we man. When you raise Chiefs, you touch us in our studio.
What are we gonna do about our Chiefs?
No, you know, I was watching Bafana Bafana, and I was speaking to my son, and I thought to myself,
"What's your son's name?"
Khosi.
Yes.
And I said to him, "Chief, you know, not a single Chiefs player would be in the Bafana Bafana squad.
Not right
now. Like, literally.
Not right now, no.
And he even suggested Ashley Depreyer. He said, maybe Karen.
No, not now.
When you can't produce national players, how do you hope to high-end no? Kusler.
Would you say we are blindly loyal, or that's what loyalty is, that you nail your colors to the mast and that's what you go with?
I think when it comes to sport, it's okay to be loyal, because I have this theory that says, Jorge, you support a team that was winning when you were young.
Oh, yes.
So now when I was growing up, because the length of the thing is that, you know, Bo, Ace Kuse, all that generation, we were winning all the time.
But in it,
so I've been there.
That's the Chiefs I grew up on.
Exactly. Yes. So now when I see these ones, I guess it's not loyalty, it's hopefulness. It's
oh, yeah.
Sense of going, maybe they will reclaim those glory days, Mare. I can't, after all that period, begere gido support among, you know.
There's also that.
You know, so I think I'm a bit, we'll keep hoping.
And we can't all go to Mamelodi Sundowns either.
But, you know, Sundowns, I want to say this on record, they are like Man City people.
Yes.
Kibuma Figi Zolo, and they've arrived, and now they're winning.
That time.
And now Kibuma. So, let them have this moment.
Jabupule was wrapped over the knuckles, I think, late last year, saying he thinks it's bad for the game that they've got all this budget and they've got a ton of players on the bench and that it's not good for the game. What are your thoughts on that?
It's football. You know, it happens all over the world. And it's said that football has to be dictated to by money. The only league that's got it half right is Germany, where the citizens of a town actually have a stake in the clubs, which means the funding model means that you really have to get players from the
It's a community effort.
You know what I mean?
Yes.
So I think that's what it is. But in South Africa, the way we structure ourselves, money is going to determine what happens. And players themselves.
Sure.
And it's not unique to soccer only. I mean, you can see it in rugby. You know, high-caliber players will go play for the franchise that will pay them well, and so they go. And then the trick that we've got to get right, I think, rather than also being overly invested in players, is to getting local coaches. Because I think there's something. I mean, if you think about Sundowns, even before they had all the stars, they had Bo Pitso, and Pitso took the team to where it is.
Yes.
If you think about relatively all the other teams.
And many thought Pitso's leaving, Rulani's in trouble. Rulani's like, no, hold my beer, let me show you.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
He's done it. And but, you know, it's also good for football.
Sure.
Because I think as a result of that, I think we're following, if you've got a strong team, if you've got a strong Barcelona and Real Madrid, you've got a strong Spanish team.
Yes.
If you've got a strong Bayern and whatever, you've got a strong German side. Little now, if you've got a strong Sundowns and anyone else, then You've got a strong national team.
Hence, most of Bafana were Sundowners.
You know what I mean? So in some ways, give or take, we are supporters of Sundowns in-laws.
Whether we want to or not. We're in-laws, yes.
In-laws of Sundowns supporters. Rebasheba on national team.
Absolutely. In fact, speaking of in-laws, I mean, this is Wow What a Week. So we're going to also discuss this week.
Yeah.
And one of the things happening this week was Valentine's. I'm going to talk about you and Retabile. So Retabile is a wifey.
Yes.
Why did your family give her that name? And what were the other options?
You know, I think my family got to a point where they were like, actually, Jida, what's going on? And then when I brought a girl home, that they thought, okay, and then they said, I Retabile. Sure. I think because my wife is Kimutu in that sense.
Ah, yes.
Very much... we had to have conversations because in a mixed race relationship, and there's always a sense upon which, given our history, and these are difficult things.
Yes,
you arrive home, you know what I mean.
Yeah.
So you got to deal with that issue.
You have to deal with the novelty first.
You know what? You know, yes. And so it was great for her to be able to come through.
Yes,
and we had to say to ourselves, you know, Mamaka is going to offer you tea.
Sure,
I want you to be the first to go umakoti in this context.
Mm.
And I knew it one when Nerile go funeraling the one time and all the women in our home, when there's a funeral, they go cook, they go...
Oh, yes, yes. Yeah, get involved. She was
standing in a line with me. Hey, my grandmother came and said, my sister, the ladies are there cooking. And yes. I just thought, I realized what we'd made progress is that they could literally treat her and say, you are one of
us. You're one of us.
So, and I think now that Keretabile, I think that came from that.
Because that's the mistake we also make, though, that, you know, there's a new makoti being brought into the family, but also because of our history, we often, you know, whether it's a subconscious thing or not, inadvertently treat white people differently.
Sure.
Even though she's one of us, she's part of the family, she'll still be treated like,
yeah, that's what I'm saying. That sense of madam, and of course these things are. I always think racism is on opposite poles of superiority and inferiority.
Absolutely.
That's why book I see when you drive a car, someone will say ungamla.
It's
to suggest that you have now amassed up the rank.
You've ascended.
And equally so, I think that attitude
we
need to be liberated from. And so I was very aware of that and conscious for arriving. Because on the other way around, I remember also going to other relatives of hers.
Yes.
And somebody would say to you, Chief, do you guys eat the same food?
Yes.
And I would be like, what did you think?
You almost feel like you're in a zoo.
Yeah, yes. You know, like now suddenly there you have to play up to the inferiority question.
Ah, yes.
And all of those issues.
Mm.
So I think one of the endearing features to my own wife is that in that way she has rejected the notion of projecting any form of whiteness and furthermore said to ourselves, I'm just kore
rinalebotho. Sure.
And we've had to work with that.
Sure.
And I'm grateful for it. You know, my family... we had to make the appropriate adjustments, and that's where she's coming in. So you've got to, it's part of the wound we've got to heal as people. To say, when you walk into a room, black or white, you claim equality before you have to claim any other sense.
Would you say being married across the color line is a political trump card, or does it work against you?
It was tough in the beginning, I won't lie. Because given the history of our country, and funny enough, firstly, in politics, people don't talk about their families that much, right? You've got political leaders, many of them.
If your family is brought up, normally it's dragged in.
And it's
never nice.
At that point, it's never nice.
Yeah.
You've lost the conversation.
Yeah.
And secondly, I can appreciate, Jorge, because of our wounded history, politically, people would be like, you'd meet a number of black women who'd say, "Runaway, where were we?"
There's the politics of that. Also.
You know, there's the politics of that.
Yes.
And furthermore, you would find in the politics of arriving in a space, people would be like, "I still even see it on Twitter."
Sure.
Ole, he's in this party. They now had to give him a white wife and all of this.
Yes.
And so it became this tension.
Yes.
And I realized even subconsciously, we were very much like, no, guys, let's not make this the foregrounding fact.
Yes.
But I realized we were wrong.
And you can't ignore it. You can't ignore it. It's like the DA is saying they don't see color.
Yeah.
You have to see color.
You have to.
Yeah.
And we were, and I remember the first interview we ever did as a family.
Sure.
Now talking with my kids and talking with my wife to say, this is who we are. Arna, and also for her, to allow her to also show her side, because I think there's prejudicial issues. There's prejudicial issues that assumes to be white is to be racist, to be black is to be this, and all of those things. Now let her be able to stand up and say, "Bona, Kinna, this is who I am." I also have to confront issues of racism, sure, even amongst our own race, and challenge those issues. So I do think the majority of South Africans, if I give them, I give credit to the fact that the majority of South Africans actually want multiracial society to work. And it was struck to me when I was doing a door-to-door in a taxi rank.
Sure.
And this taxi guy says to me, "Enhleko, where's your wife?" And I thought, this is odd.
Yeah.
Taxi driver asking about my wife.
Sure.
Like, where do we...
Yeah.
And then he said to me something profound. He said, "Ronamo, in these streets, we want to see races together. And we want to know that for white South Africans to come to a taxi rank is not an abnormal thing.
Absolutely.
And you need to normalize that in society."
Exactly.
So to me, I think it's a... some ways, it's a progress of... Dinzuhalo, I nearly said. it's a celebration of where our country has been.
So you guys as a couple are Dinzuhalo, basically.
A few decades ago, we were committing a crime.
Yes,
you know,
absolutely.
Just as recent as that.
Mm.
But I do appreciate, Ore, we also represent, we didn't do it politically.
Sure.
But I think it gives us a pathway to say to South Africans, actually, there is a way to heal our own woundedness as a society.
Yes, sir. You remind me of my uncle. So uncle of mine in the 80s, he worked in New York for a while. So he came home. We're at the village. I think I was 13, 14. And he brings home an American wife. She's white. In fact, I think she was Latina. She was Latina. And there was just this commotion in the village.
Sure.
That my uncle has brought home a white wife. And even at that level, I felt like, no, man, she's just one of us. But she was being treated with these. And she wants to blend in.
Yeah.
Because I'm home with my husband. I've come to Africa for the first time.
Yeah.
But, you know, the old ladies want to treat her like, no, she's a glass doll. You know, she's a China doll, and she must be treated in a certain way.
Cool.
So I'm thinking, you know, that's the stuff you had to navigate,
and we've had to.
Yeah.
And that's what I'm saying. That's on the one side of the
family.
You can also appreciate her on the other side.
Did it ever get hairy on her side of the family?
Yeah, I wanna. On the other side of the issue is that you arrive and maybe not so much with the immediate family, but I can remember
there's always an uncle
in the extended family.
Yeah.
There's an uncle now wants to say, "Ah, Chita,
yeah,
why do you do that? You are betraying us. You are from her side."
Sure.
We had people.
So you brought us the help.
You know what I mean?
Yes.
We had people who said, "We are not coming to the wedding." And like, you are doing something here that is not right. And I think we all fear what we do not know. And so we had to invest at saying, "Hore," even in the midst of that pain and that difficulty. Because there were days where you say to yourself, I mean, we got married in the early 2000s, so the idea of democracy in 94 was still fairly newish in that sense.
There's still that euphoria.
You know, there was still, and ex-Model C schools were not all that massive in the country, and so that integration was always quite tricky. We had to allow ourselves the grace to say, look, regardless of, because sometimes I think we can immediately slap on "you are racist" label.
Sure.
Without willing to confront the question and allow people to grow through it.
Absolutely.
Because in truth, sometimes we can prejudge situations. You've got to walk it through. And now we've got kids. We've got three kids. They've got to navigate it through themselves. The new identity of being mixed race. They will suffer from some of the critique that Tyler has gotten from the Grammys.
Oh, yes.
All of those issues. How do you identify? You know, even sometimes I see my own daughter putting up posters that say Black Lives Matter. And therefore you think, okay, where does she fill into that space? You see your own son, all of those issues, names, language, you know, what language do they first become conversant in? So we're going to have to navigate through all of those those things.
Yes, sir. One of the other big stories this week, Justice Mogoeng says the good Lord has given him a message that he needs to run for president. He also spoke about how his life was in danger. Just last month, he heard that he was supposed to be taken out. How dangerous is what you do? Firstly, before we drag the good Lord in, because he's, I want to drag him in also.
I will not deny it. I think there have been moments, and heading into an election is always has its own vulnerabilities, because you've got zealots of parties who feel incentivized to a bit like joining a gang that you can take out one from the other gang and show people. So there is a danger towards that. And I think as the world is becoming more conflictual, if you think about the geopolitical conflicts that we are engaged with, sometimes you yourself walk around and you think, I represent a particular view to someone.
Sure.
And so there is, on the grassroots level, I've often worried, less so for my own life, but more so for my own family. Because sometimes when you take the gamble of going, where's South African family, you need to keep in mind that your kids find themselves in spaces that you can't protect.
In fact, Minister Pando was saying the other day that her kids are getting threats now since the ICJ thing.
Yeah. So that's what I'm saying. And being in spaces that we're in often has that difficulty when I look at it. And so there is a danger to the thing. I think I've had in my own life periodically where people have felt, I even had a call from the police commissioner saying, we've got this intelligence. You need to think about where you are, what you are doing, all of those things. So
when you get a call like that, like what's going through your head as you're hearing these things?
You just, there's a dynamic.
Because I can tell you now, I'm cucking myself as I'm hearing it. If I'm hearing it, I'm like, why did I not wear my diaper today?
You're like, maybe it's a degree of faith.
Sure.
You just think to yourself, we in this thing because we feel a deep sense of call and faith.
Sure.
I hold on my desk a picture of Mandela's cell without him in it.
Sure.
Because sometimes I have to remind myself, others went through worse.
Sure.
Sure, I'll get threats, but others went through worse. Mm. Like genuinely, when I then sober up the discussion.
Sure.
To say when you walk into a place, I was once locked up in a factory. I was busy speaking to someone behind it, and a whole lot of ANC supporters came and they blocked out the front end of the thing.
Jeez.
And to get out there, we had to, like, literally it was like people could throw whatever and do whatever, and it happens. You have to say to yourself, others have been through worse. Sure. I mean, and that's why I celebrate sometimes those who fought the struggle, because there were others who, I mean, you know, I listened to some of the interviews by people like Mac Maharaj and what took place in detention. And when I think about people like Winnie Mandela, when I think about all of those, my most recent book I just actually read was Johnny Steinberg's book, A Portrait of Marriage, between lessons between Mandela and Winnie.
Sure.
And for the, you know, you realize there's something about being locked up in prison and being told you can't attend the funeral of your own child.
Absolutely.
That's devastating.
No, absolutely.
And so when you get threats, you just think to yourself, there are others who have been through this. And if it's worth doing, you have to be willing to face up to whatever the options are. And I was lying in bed last night thinking, funny you asked me this. I was lying in bed last night and thinking, is this worth your life? Is this worth?
Is it worth dying for?
Is it?
Is it worth dying for?
And you have to, with a degree of trepidation, and
like not like touch wood.
You know, courage isn't the absence of fear. We've heard that. Of course, I fear for my life, but you still have to wake up every day taking a choice to say, it's best be courageous. Because if you genuinely believe in what you're doing, then be willing to pay whatever price, and if it's the ultimate price, it is. I wouldn't want for my kids to go through it. I don't want for my wife to be to be a widow for fear that she might date someone else. No, but but in the main, you have to say to yourself, is it worth the fight? And I think for this country, it certainly is.
Where do we draw the line between knowing the religious society that we are? Where do we draw the line between just vote for me and God said I must stand now? Because it almost feels like a mini guilt trip. You dragging the good Lord into your standing. You know what I mean?
You know, like for
and me, you're a pastor.
So
you know,
I think to not be preachy, Jesus has asked the same question about laws and all sorts of things. And I think the standard response is to love God and love your neighbor. I think sometimes we can make the position whatever.
Sure.
The thing that we draw people to say, look at that. That's what I've been called to do. But actually, I think to sum it all up, just wake up in the morning and figure out, am I loving God? And then ultimately, am I serving the people? Because I've had to think hard about that question. I've had to think hard about going, what if in all your journey, you don't achieve all you've done? Actually, the journey is always the destination. Actually, to wake up every day. You know, the things I celebrate the most is when we wake up and we go to a community.
Sure.
We find people without water. We do what we need to do. You wake up every other day and you think to yourself, there's a child who can't go to school. How do I help that? Or you go to... So there is that loving your neighbor stuff. But also, it mustn't be reduced to just good deeds. It must also be reduced to advocacy, where you say, I hate the acts of racism. I hate the exclusion. So I'm going to fight for it. I'm going to go to parliament and change laws because we love this country. So to me, I'm never worried about the position so much as taking the posture that says, you'll know me by what I do. And if you like what I do, then vote for it. But if you don't, recognize that that's what you're going to get more in droves going forward.
Now, as a deeply religious society that we are, you'd think the Christian parties would do well in a country such as ours. Why is it that they're not doing as well as they could or should?
I think in the main, people of faith wake up asking questions about whether the lights will go on, whether they'll feel safe, whether they will have a job. And when I look at even the biblical heroes you might cite, I think people like, if you take the typical story, Joseph was an economist. Maybe Moses was the early days Martin Luther King. The struggle is never just to say, here's my faith, therefore vote for it. The struggle is always that when people go vote, they hold a referendum on their future. And you as a leader need to be able to help that without even necessarily waking up and saying, thus saith the Lord. People must know you have a need. You know, when you own justice and you say, I see racial injustice, you don't have to say it's because the Bible says so. You just do it because you genuinely hold the idea of justice paramount, or you want people to prosper. But it's not just going to be like automated. That's why I'm always very conscious. I'm finishing a PhD now. And part of why I do that is because I didn't just think, I've got to read my own Bible so that when I look at the economics of the country, I can offer solutions that work. One of the indictments, I think, amongst many Christians, Christian leaders, and Christian parties is that they haven't worked, invested enough at going, what are the solutions for society? Like, how do we keep the lights on?
You can't throw the Bible at it.
You know, how do we keep the lights on? How do we keep people safe? How do we create an economy that works? And, you know, my faith dictates how I look at the issue of humanity. I still have to find solutions. I've got to find solutions. And I think sometimes that's why Christian parties don't do well, is because it's like the age-old saying, and I've got to say this, it's fine that someone is a Christian who happens to do plumbing. But may they be a very good plumber. Because once the pipes are leaking, we are not going to pray over there.
You can't pray that way.
You can't say, hey, man, this toilet is blocked. Let's lay hands on it. Let's get the best plumber to come and fix the thing, right? And if they are Christians, good on. But it's important that they're able to fix the pipes.
Tell us about this PhD. And when are you done?
Hopefully this year. It's been a journey. I started just before COVID.
You started a lot of things just before COVID.
Hey, man.
Even had a COVID child.
I did. But look, COVID was tough. People were suffering. I was watching the scoreboard. You know, as people were dying, I said, what am I doing? What did you do for?
So you decided to what? To add to the population?
Bayans. Others are like, no, I learned how to play guitar, so I have a child.
I tried banana bread, and then after eating half the banana, I was like, it's not going to work.
No. We fell pregnant before the lockdown, so yeah. It was a shock, but and a welcome shock.
Yeah, absolutely.
For my little one.
Yes, sir.
But it's in economics because mm-hmm. I've always been fascinated by that, and I always think that I'm doing an autoethnographic study about how politics and economics intersect at a local mm-hmm. government,
mm-hmm.
because you and I, we can debate state capture, we sure. can debate the currency mm-hmm. and monetary policy and all of that, but what we cannot debate is that if a municipality,
mm-hmm.
i.e. Joburg, cannot fix potholes, keep the lights on, reticulate water, mm. and make sure we are safe.
Mm.
Those are the things that affect us.
Sure.
That's where the rubber does in fact hit the road.
Mm.
And so that's been the study. I'm about 85-80% of the way. I hopefully will submit mid-year and then graduate towards the end of the year. So that's the big trick. And I had a professor, a Muslim man, Mohammed Jahed, who's one of my favorite South Africans.
Mm.
He came to me and said, young man, we are not going to vote for a president who hasn't got a PhD. I said, hey, he challenged me. It's like, and that's every time. He was the first guy I attended an economics lecture.
Yes.
And it, like you can imagine, I only finished a master's in theology. And so now I come to do a master's in economics. And I'm there. And he was the first person to say, Musi, you have to do a PhD in economics. Mm. And he challenged me. And since to this day, I feel indebted to him. To say, I have to do this thing. And like my supervisor and the team that is working with me to make sure, I've been so grateful. They've challenged me. Mm. I want to do it.
Africa has had...
Also, just as a side...
Yes, sir.
Aren't we all tired of sending people to parliament, Bona Lady Matriki and all of that? I think we got to do better.
I think that's probably... where we're calling people lawmakers... But
like you arrive there, you think, and that was part of the dilemma. When you arrived in parliament, you sometimes sit there and you say, bro, we are debating this issue, but I can hear Horemo again.
Yes.
And it be
and it has nothing even to do with how well you speak English.
No.
It's just you're in over your head. Full stop. That's all.
The further you study,
mm.
as someone said, it's the irrational man who is certain.
Sure.
Rationality makes you uncertain.
Yes.
The more you study, the more you are willing to hear another point of view that challenges you to say, okay.
And the more you understand that generally life is a contestation of ideas.
Correct.
So let me listen to your idea.
So that I'm, and out of that, we can synergistically produce an idea that works for all. Now, I got frustrated. And I can appreciate when somebody says, under apartheid, people couldn't get a school. So it's okay for someone to go to parliament without a post-matric qualification.
Sure.
But I don't think we have that excuse today.
No, we don't.
If we're going to show our kids, there must be an aspiration to what they do. We have to ourselves, as leaders, equip ourselves. And also at the same time is that it would be unfair to my father, who I thought... was an incredibly smart man. Both my parents are smarter than me.
Mm.
But thanks to apartheid, my mother didn't complete her own high school.
Mm.
And so we are obligated, I think, as the next generation of South Africans to say, where can we stretch this thing further? So that in our communities, people must be able to know, if you have a doctorate, you're not just Dr. Kumalo, but you have a doctorate in something. So I've become... an advocate for education.
Sure.
And I had to say to myself, I've got to prove it to say I want to get educated so that the next generation can also get educated.
Now, Africa has a long history of very educated leaders. you know, going back to the time of the OAU, you know, going back to even recent times, whether it's, you know, looking at former President Festus Mogae, who was an economist, or Thabo Mbeki, who was an economist. Who are some of the African leaders you look up to in terms of, you know, they knew what the heck they were doing. They knew what the heck they were saying.
You know, there's a variety of people. And, you know, I've just finished a whole thing on someone like Anwar Sadat, who even at the time of leading that part of the world was fighting for things beyond their time. They're not all perfect, but they produce something.
You know the weird thing? Sorry to interject. Because my dad was in politics and civil service, I read a lot.
Yeah.
So even at the assassination of Anwar Sadat, I was a child.
Sure.
But just reading about it, I almost felt a heaviness because I understood that what the heck is going on here. And that's why I appreciate why reading will open your eyes and your mind to just so much more and help you understand so much more. And my love for politics, my love for current affairs, my love for, you know, talking to people like such as yourself is because my dad made sure we read.
That's, and we've...
Because Time Magazine, I had to read it.
Kyo.
I had to read it.
I mean, even now, even for my own kids, I have to say to them, Bona, at least at a basic level, you should be watching the news.
Yes.
Lowly, when you read, I mean, and unfortunately today, you know, smartphones allow us to get things like News 24 and all that kinds of online publications that people read.
Sure.
And so I always thought I wanted to shake President Mandela's hand.
Sure.
But I always wanted to sit and have a long-term debate with President Mbeki.
Yes.
I never got to do the first, which is to shake Mandela's hand, but I've been able to have the privilege to engage President Mbeki on a number of occasions and to walk away from that. You know who else I'm a massive fan and it would seem quite, but President Motlanthe.
Yes.
Is South African.
What a gent.
I admire because his argument is loud, strong, without him being aggressive.
Absolutely.
He does produce. And I've always found when I sit with him, walk away and you think to yourself, I've learned a lot.
Even where I might not agree with you.
Correct. And that's the thing about so in Africa, I've had opportunities to even engage people like Olusegun Obasanjo.
Yes.
Obi, who was the Minister of Education in Nigeria at the time, is probably one of the more fascinating women you can meet as a woman leader.
Sure.
She's able to produce just some really insights about education, but probably more than anything, she's spent a lot of time just trying to inspire me about this issue of education. So there are some.
You're talking about Anwar Sadat, yes.
Yeah.
Before I interjected, what?
I was saying,
yeah.
If I think about the conflict in the Middle East,
sure.
Anwar Sadat, with his speech that he delivered, demonstrates the courage at the time to have foresaw a world without conflict, even in some way speaking at length about the existence of both Israelis and Palestinians. That was foresight.
Sure.
And now you think about the conflict we have today. These are incredible people who have chartered a way in these issues.
Why is it that it's always the good ones that get taken out, though? Like a Sadat.
Yeah.
Or the ones who speak uncomfortable truths. Or truth to power. Or are willing to say to the West, no, this is wrong.
Sure. I think sometimes part of it is...
Is this just a conspiracy theory? Maybe I'm just a conspiracy theorist.
No, I think bad people also get taken out.
Well, yeah.
You know, but the difficulty is that we note the ones that... Because I think human beings have an inbuilt sense of love and justice. And so when someone says it to us, we take notice of it because it's the closest we have to ourselves. And then when they get taken out, it hurts us more because we feel a part of us going with that person. I think we don't always notice when the evil ones get taken out because I think they're just so many people, particularly in political leadership, who are mass positions, that we tend to think to ourselves, that's not resembling of us. That's not who. I mean, when I think about, even when we take our own democratic history, we take periods of time, there have been some great leaders. There have been leaders. I mean, I entered politics in some ways because I was, as a child, watching the gunning down of Chris Hani. And I thought to myself, this is an injustice that we've got to do. And that's why maybe my first political leanings were part of the ANC. And now today, trying to reclaim that space of going, how do we build a centrist view of the world and change? So I think...
In fact, that was actually my next question, that you grew up ANC, but decided, can't fix this from here, so need to go there. Tell us about that quickly.
I think because I think liberation movements achieve the job of liberation.
Sure.
And fail the task of governance. And because they fail the task of governance.
But why are they not learning from previous liberation movements?
Because it's difficult when your identity was steeped in liberation to change your identity.
Or is this hence the nostalgia often?
That's why I still find it strange today that you can find a, you don't have a communications directorate. You have the Ministry of Propaganda. I mean, sure. I'm like, in what universe are you talking about this? And you still have even political formations that still have fairly Marxist views steeped into them. You have this. I think the problem is that liberation movements don't modernize because it's a change of identity and therefore have to keep reminding people what you are liberating them from.
Sure. Despite the fact that the struggle has changed.
Yeah. And you have to, and to put that argument forward, you have to say, we are liberating you either A, from the whites, or A, from that system.
There must always be a boogeyman.
There must always be, to be able to keep your own cause.
Your own relevance.
Yes. And to be honest with you, I recognize that if we stay, philosophically speaking, we are going to keep repeating cycles of one race oppressing another.
Sure.
So if you look at South Africa's history, you know, almost at a long-term level, if you say, you had a colonialist history, that is one race in oppression to another. Apartheid, as Helena Opperman's book says, was like, you know, in her book, Brit, almost colonialism's bastard child, produced apartheid, which was another recycling of a type of nationalism. Post-apartheid politics means you have one another liberation movement coming on board saying, we will liberate you from those. We can't then say, what are we waiting for? Are we waiting for the next liberation movement to liberate us from this?
From the liberators.
So what we've got to figure out is, as the Kenyans so eloquently put it, at first we must be liberated, and then we must liberate ourselves from the liberators. Yes. Because when we do that, we can introduce a new politics. My kids must think about politics differently. They must
be held hostage.
And they must participate in politics differently. Like, I'm not convinced about notions like join a branch, join this. I think the moment you do that, you steep into this loyalism.
Nothing's changing.
Yeah, and this loyalism that says that becomes our team versus your team. And I think the Americans are suffering from that space where they might red team, blue team. No, we must pick what's best for the country.
Speaking of which, then, if that's what we want to do, there's a bunch of brilliant young South Africans such as yourselves that are now part of either political formations or brand new parties. And my argument is, if it is about king and country, what stops you guys from choosing one of you to stand forward, represent everyone else, and everyone else say, listen, we're here to support you.
Sure.
Well, I will be a minister if at all we get there.
Yeah.
But if there's a ton of you, and all of you brilliant in your own right, saying no, me.
I think it's a system.
Yeah.
It's a systems problem. The current electoral system means everything is proportional.
Oh, yes.
Which means that in a PR system, you can have everybody going, me. But there will come a day after the elections where we will all have to sit down and say, well, let's pick that one.
Yes.
So I think it's more the system allows for a deferred decision rather than one now. Mm. If we had a constituency-based system, on the other hand, which I think Botswana has to a certain extent, you can have pre-deals that make it easier to say, Bon, when you are strong in KZN, focus on that. You are strong in Gauteng. You are strong in the Northern Cape. Come together. I also think that for South Africans, we need to realize that conversation is being had, to be honest with you. I think you'll find there'll be better harnessing of views that eventually come down to say, the job of electing the president of the country is can't just be done flippantly. It must be a well-considered view that says, here's a plan, here's how we're going to do it, here's how we're going to bring people together. And ultimately, as the people decide, they'll also be able to go, we think that guys should, because I think, maybe this is more the spiritual in me, not everybody who stands up and says, I could be the president, should be the president.
In the first place.
I think there is a particular moment in a society where the affairs of man are orchestrated to bring particular people at a time to lead. And therefore, I think that moment for us as a country is on its way. I'm confident we'll find each other. I'm already speaking to political parties across various spectrum. And the diversity of South Africa means that you almost have to have a leader who has the temperament to be able to say, you know, for the purpose of this country, I must be willing to hear from an Afrikaner. I must be willing to hear from a Zulu nationalist. I must be willing to hear from that person so that we can come together around these ideals that take the country forward. In fact, one of my favorite quotes perhaps maybe is from someone like Konrad Adenauer, a German first, who dealt with this question of unification, dealt with this question of bringing people together, said, actually, what we've always got to do is that the job of leadership is about figuring out the country's story and telling on the next chapter. That's what the president does. And so for me, I think we've got to find that and say the next chapter of the story of post-liberation politics must be told. Because if we get stuck in this moment, as the song goes, we can't get out of it.
And nothing changes.
Nothing changes.
There's nothing changes.
And the truth of the matter is, as a country, we're suffering because, as the president articulated at SONA, he painted a beautiful vision of a better yesterday. Walking away from the speech, I couldn't think, what is my tomorrow going to be? Therefore, in the light of all of that, we have to arrive at a point where we say, what is the tomorrow we want? We can't, as much, I love my parents. I don't have a, I can't produce a better dream for them at the expense of my own kids.
Absolutely. If you were tasked with advising President Ramaphosa pre-SONA, how would have SONA gone?
If you are going to use SONA as an election speech, elections are always a referendum about the future. On balance, you can't have a speech that says, congratulate me. I thought it was a tribute speech to President Mbeki more than anything. So it was like, hey, you know, I think that's what he got wrong.
Yes.
I would have said to him, forget, let someone else tell the story of 30 years of democracy.
Yes.
You have to
bring Tintoro in.
Let someone else
tell it.
Let someone else tell it. What your job must be is to tell us what the next 30 years is going to look like.
Yes.
And I think he failed at that basic task because none of us are going to go to the polls and say, we thank you. In fact, many of us are going to go to the polls and say, well, we've got load shedding, we've got this, we've got that. Those are the challenges. We are unemployed, so we need to find people. The job now for South Africa, we've transitioned. What does South Africa 10 years, 20, 30 years from now look like? And whoever owns that will own the future. And I thought the president said, I don't own that. And that's a function of age.
So wasted opportunity.
The opportunity has been able to articulate that. And I think that's where, for me, I've had to, as tough as it is, to always say, I see a South Africa where South Africans, regardless of race, can prosper together. There must be a South African where, when we talk about shared prosperity, more people find work. We must build more infrastructure. We must ensure that tomorrow our kids are educated to compete with anyone. And in a world that's fast digitizing, how do we ensure that our citizens are much more able to compete with anyone in the world thanks to a quality education?
We're not left in the dust by the Kenyans. I mean, the Kenyans are streets ahead.
They are already innovating on payment platforms, etc. We are falling behind. And so we need to be intentional about what does that tomorrow look like. And I think that's actually the task.
Now, I'm aware that you've got time constraints, and I think even your management are saying, you need to wrap up. You have 10 minutes. We need to leave soon. Bossa.
Yes.
Why do I need to vote for Bossa? What are you guys going to do differently? Like, what makes you guys...
It's already what we've been doing to
people. Yes. Yeah.
One, I left Parliament because I thought it was politics for politicians.
Sure.
I didn't want to start another party because I didn't want disgruntled people following me and say, yeah, we are angry there. Let's start here. I said, let's go out first and foremost and identify. Let's get back to the communities.
Sure.
So we fought the Electoral Act to say, let's allow for direct elections of people. Secondly, we've identified unbelievably talented people. You know, for me, the pain in this country is that we don't have ethical leadership serving in Parliament.
Mm.
We found some unbelievable talent. Mm. I mean, many South Africans would be introduced to Ayanda Ali in a more recent one.
Mm.
But Ayanda is like, you know, taking a sip out of a fire hydrant. She is a force.
Yeah.
But I can tell you that along with Ayanda, there's Nobuntu, there's Lumka, there's people like Kathy, there's Tanya. I can list a whole lot of women who, when I look at, I realize there's an unbelievable talent. When I look at the candidates that communities have given us, we didn't go say to them, "Kia listia rona."
Sure.
Even the ones who are in state capture will appear. We went to the community and says, pick the best, and they gave us the best. So that's the first. The second is, we've genuinely shown what it means to be a government in working rather than waiting.
Mm.
So I've invested a lot in communities, fixing boreholes. We've set up blended learning education facilities where people can come through. I myself left Parliament and said, I'm underskilled. Let me go reskill myself.
Sure.
So I did, the study is but one thing. But I got involved in business, right?
Mm-hmm.
So we set up a fund to help fund startup businesses.
Mm.
But we also were intentional at going, how do we help entrepreneurs come forward? Because I don't want to talk what I don't experience.
Mm-hmm.
So now, in myself, I'm coming back with a new toolkit. So to answer your question, I think when you look at the ballot, you are going to see black parties, you are going to see white parties, you are going to see Indian parties, colored parties.
Mm.
They may not call themselves like that, but they certainly represent some form of biological feature to which none of us can change. Zulu parties, regional parties, religious parties. Bossa is about the only party I can say comfortably. When you find us in the ballot, you'll find a South Africa for all. You'll find that those South Africans have a shared vision of a prosperous South Africa that delivers jobs. You'll also find, in the midst of that, that the most ethical leadership sits there. That, for me, is a powerful cause to fight for and a powerful cause to maintain for the future of my own kids.
In fact, speaking of the future of your own kids, in terms of education, what would you guys do differently?
I've said, let's scrap this 30% thing.
Mm.
And I know people are like, right? Because when your scoreboard at the end of the day says mediocrity, everything else follows suit. Your teachers settle for mediocrity. Your headmaster settle for mediocrity.
So it's a mindset thing.
It is.
Mm.
I mean, if we learn anything from, you would know Botswana very well. Botswana were very intentional about educating citizens. I grant them that. They were, and when they didn't have always the universities for it, I can remember going to universities in South Africa through a bursary program called Botswana where they forced and funded people to get educated in this
country. They were sent pretty much to every corner of the world.
And you could go to Harvard and found Botswana. You could go anywhere. Now, that was leadership that recognized the fact that if we're going to move up the curve, we have to educate our citizens. So for me, I'm going, let's scrap that. Let's make it 50.
Sure.
Let's make sure we build the appropriate infrastructure. We can't be discussing today kids dying in pet latrines. It's crap. I need to set another word that, but I won't. But we equally so have to say to ourselves, how do we get, let alone the teaching component right, how do we ensure that infrastructure, digital infrastructure is put on the table? How do we offer an education ombudsman who can monitor what happens that mutes in some ways the power of unions to electing principals.
Sure.
And let's ultimately produce an education for the future that then says the kids have a pipeline. Because here's a dilemma. If 8 out of 10 of our kids cannot read for meaning by the age of 10, that means their matric pass rate becomes meaningless. So let's make sure in the first 1,000 days, kids are well fed, they've got proper ECD centers. Let's pay teachers better, mm-hmm. particularly those in the STEM subjects. Let's give a national civilian year post-school so that in that post-matric year, kids, young people have got an opportunity to go work in an internship program, because we're not always going to all go do a university degree.
I was part of a similar one in BOTS.
Yeah.
Straight out of high school. We had to do national service for a year.
Correct.
And it was compulsory.
Yeah.
But the way it worked is, do your national service, we're going to send you to school.
Sure.
And that gap year did a ton for me, because I'm working in a community I've never worked in before. Yeah. I'm giving back to the country. And I'm also taking a gap year to actually find myself and to develop a work ethic outside of just the schooling system.
And you share values, right?
Absolutely.
Because in a fragmented society, sometimes you can find what you want. A child who's grown up in Sandton to go work in Alex.
Yeah.
So that...
to spend a year working in Alex.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So that when they stand up and you know, in South Africa, we have others who celebrate Springboks, others who celebrate Bafana. We need all to celebrate the Springboks, all to celebrate Bafana, all to celebrate Tyler. So because it's part of that national...
We're on the same boat, and exactly. If it sinks, we all die.
We all... That's it.
There are no compartments for who's going to die first.
Well, you can't say Babo Stellenbosch.
Yes. They don't have like a separate arc. Why the same arc?
No, exactly. So, yeah. So it's about that shared values discussion that allows in that year's program, and then post that to be able to say, if there's a student whose parents could not go to university because of the history we come from,
sure,
we as the state must be obligated to fund it, but not only fund it, recoup that cost when they get their first job.
Sure.
Because once they get their first job, you can increase their taxation by a few percentage points. And they can pay it back
into the kitty
kitty for the next one, so that you keep your end of the bargain, which is to say, so mu pasa and get through, and we keep our end of the bargain, sure. to say your education must be deployed in the economy, and so we keep going.
Sure. Now, I often hear people talking about there's a genocide, white farmers are being killed. There's also there's GBV, and my argument always is, I'm not going to take anything from anyone who feels white farmers are being targeted or people who feel GBV is a problem. It is a problem. But I generally feel we have a bigger issue here. We have a violence problem.
Exactly.
Regardless of who you are, we are all under siege. We have a violence problem. And if we were to look at the stats, you know, what stops a guy from saying, actually, as a black male, more of us are being killed every weekend than any other...
70 to be exact, to be killed every single day in this country.
This is just black males.
Murder in general.
Generally,
then I would imagine black males fulfill a larger proportion.
That's the point I'm making, that, you know, depending on which team you want to bat for, we can all argue that someone is under siege. But the bottom line is, we have a massive violence problem in this country.
And sometimes even tagging labels like genocide and all of that,
yeah,
is to give those who are committing that crime and murder the dignity they don't deserve.
Absolutely.
It's a bit like you make them mercenaries, yes. Like they're fighting some cause. What crap is that? The truth of the matter is that you are correct.
What we need,
we have a violence problem. We have a murder problem. But to fix, we have equally a policing problem.
Sure.
Police are underfunded and understaffed. We have a deficit of over 100,000 police. What I think we need to philosophically think about it this way. We need to say, how do we decentralize policing, move away from the SAPs and bring them to lower down?
Sure.
That's important. Why? Because intelligence. We're not being murdered. We're not creating new murderers every day.
They're not someone from outside. It's your neighbor.
We need the intelligence to know, but we also need to know, once we've got that intelligence, how do we cooperate with the criminal justice system so that those people end up behind bars? That's the first. The second is, we can then add the manpower. I mean, I drive around Joburg and the Metro Police stop me just to check my license disc. I'm like, what a waste of manpower.
Sure.
Why can't we use that manpower, merge it with a localized policing system, allow for private security to be partnered with that,
sure.
so that we can deploy an immediate amount of force quickly and effectively when a crime is occurring. And then to the National Civilian Service issue, you augment that with more young people who can come and volunteer and do work. Now you've got more eyes on criminals. It's closer to the ground. You are increasing capacity, but you have to prioritize murder. And I think that's a good place to start, because sometimes when a police detective is confronted with a motor vehicle accident, they are confronted with Vahabigi, focus on murder. Let's go to that. And we saw when we do those little things, even though we didn't change constitutionality of policing, murder rate in this country was lower in 2010, just before 2009 to 2010, just before the World Cup, because we capacitated it.
Sure.
And if you can remember, during the World Cup, Nero Tsama, you see Maberete, you see these ones. There was a sense upon which
there was a country, presence.
There was a presence.
There was a don't mess around.
Wabon?
Yeah.
Now today, in truth, people, the only people living in fear are citizens. The criminals are walking around.
Emboldened.
So I do think we need to be intentional about that issue. And as the measures I've put in place, I think we could be able to see much better return on it.
To NHI or not to NHI?
I'll produce a third model, which is to let the state be the underwriter.
Sure.
Because actually, both assets, public and private, are crucial.
Sure.
But let's say you live in Limpopo, and the closest doctor to you is a private medical doctor. Let citizens go there and let the state pay.
Ah, yes.
Because it underwrites the issue.
Sure.
But let's assume you live in Cape Town, and the best liver specialist happens to work in Groteskier, a public institution, but you're a private medical aid client.
Sure.
You must go to that asset, and that asset must be able to pay through your medical aid to the public coffers. So we keep at a primary level of healthcare availability of services to all citizens, and at a tertiary level we can make sure that the payment platform is underwritten by both the state and your medical aid provider, so that we can benefit. So I do think we've got to build that model, and we've got to allow the underwriting of services more than the sense that all health institutions must be nationalized.
In closing, and often you hear this on talk shows or talk radio, that the country is rudderless, that there's no hope that we're the next Zimbabwe. Is it as hopeless as people think it is?
No, I don't think so. You know, to quote someone like Jan Smuts, he said, South Africa is the country where the worst never happens, and I guess the best is always too distant.
Yes.
So I don't think this country is doom and gloom. I don't. I genuinely don't. I think
agree with you.
We've got unbelievable people in this country. Yeah, you and I can sit here, we can do this, and we can dominate the world. I just think Ayanda summed it up well. We don't measure ourselves against developing countries or Zimbabwe. We should measure ourselves against our own potential.
Sure.
And against our own potential, we are falling behind.
Absolutely.
And I think that's what we should be saying. When I used to teach for a little bit, and sometimes when you can meet a student who gets 60%, but that's the maximum they could do. And you meet another student who gets the same 60%, but you know they can get 80%.
Yes. As the report would say, does not apply himself.
It does not, you know. Are you reading my report?
We are not applying ourselves. Yeah.
So South Africa is not applying it, you know, yeah.
So we're not the best versions of ourselves. And I think deep down inside, we know that.
We're not.
There's no reason why we're not in the top 10 in the world. At anything.
Correct.
At anything.
You know, when we shouldn't be surprised Bafana Bafana being in the top four in the continent.
At all.
But I'm glad they did. But they give us glimmers of saying, Mario, you are underperforming.
Yes.
Like, we shouldn't be surprised and that's what I love about this country. In our diversity, sure, it has its stresses.
Sure.
Because sometimes we miss each other in language and in many things. But how in rugby we surprise you at soccer? Sure. When you say that we win at the Grammys, when you say that we produce the best healthcare systems, or we produce some unbelievable business people, so against our own potential,
yes,
we could be, and I think we were heading that way.
Sure.
I think we lost our way, and I think we need to now say, South Africa, imagine if our target was to say, let's at least go back to the Premier League.
Sure.
Because whether it's financial systems, all of that, education systems, healthcare systems, we've been downgraded to use football. That's what we are playing.
Sure.
We need to, let's us at least say to ourselves, our target for the next 5 years to get back in the Premier League, and then the 5 years after that, play Champions League, because we can be in the top 12 nations. And if Japan could do it, they move themselves up the curve, we can do it.
And Japan did it with such a simple thing. We need the best in there.
Correct.
Regardless of what that needs to happen, is this the best person for the job? That's all the Japanese did.
And
all they did.
people often ask me, what are you going to do in the first 100 days?
Yeah.
I say to themselves, almost planning and policy is one thing.
Yeah.
Attract the best for government because they're there.
That's all.
I mean, think about, you know, I get frustrated. Sometimes you go to the Home Affairs and you get there, and I love the civil servants in the Home Affairs.
Sure.
You get the order, the system is down.
Mm.
I've never been to a bank.
Mm.
When my bank goes down, they send warning and red flags.
Yes, it's a crisis. It's a crisis.
It's an hour.
Yes.
And if I've had that in the last 5 years, it's been maybe cumulatively 5 hours.
So why are we not using the same system the banks are using?
If the banks...
Or the same talent they have,
you know,
so that the system is never down.
Correct.
Do we have the best person for the job in every position?
I think that's where South Africa, we've lost our way. We said to ourselves, the state is the best leader of development, and then proceeded to send the worst, particularly in elected officials, to the state.
Sure.
That's what we did. And then we ended up with a situation where people say, bro, now we are here, but we can't achieve those things. What I'm trying to get to is to say, that's why BOSA, let's elect the best to go to parliament.
Sure.
Because once you've got the best, they set the tone down. Mm-hmm. You've got the best DGs, you've got the best, and then let's minimize certain things. You know, technology allows us to do more for less.
Mm.
So yes, people say you are driving for jobs, but you are saying, no, I'm not trying. The state is what the state is.
Sure.
But the problem is that you've got people in senior leadership who don't do their jobs and end up in a space where the culture filters down.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, we've got the best rugby side, the best soccer side, the best cricket side, the best musicians. Let's get the best government.
Let's replicate all of that across every sphere.
Suddenly people will say to us, no, Bale, you can't.
Because the people are there.
Yeah.
The people are there.
They're there. And
more often than not, are willing to say, coach, put me on. That's all they want. Coach, put me on.
And we can't, because sometimes we have to say to them, belong to this party.
Yeah.
Let's let the state breathe.
Sure.
You'll even find, even within the Home Affairs officials, there are those who want to get to the top, but they can't because they're not politically connected.
Mm.
You can't run a system like that. Get the best to the top quickly, and let's make sure. Let me close it like this. I sometimes say to myself, you know, if I played golf, and you said you'll play against Tiger Woods, I don't want to talk about Tiger's life. I'll reflect on his championship.
Sure.
And I said to Tiger, here's some plastic clubs. You can figure your way out. Now I'll use these proper ones.
Sure.
I'll beat him all day, all the time. Because I've got the best clubs.
Mm.
And I'm not saying his talent is just the best club. Sure. It's just that you need the best group of South Africans working together to achieve the changes that we need. Once we do that, this country's latent potential tells me, we will fly. There's
like I said,
over $1.3 trillion looking for investment. I'm saying bring it here. Because as the world is changing through climate change and all of those things, all that money means we can dominate.
Absolutely.
We are young. We are vibrant. We are in the continent of Africa. 1.4 billion people will be here in 2040. The median age is 23. My gosh, if I look at that, I think we are the next rising...
Absolutely.
...block.
The next rising sun.
We are it. So let's get our politics right.
Sure.
We can show the world this is where it's at.
Musi,
my brother.
Nothing but love and respect for you.
Likewise.
And I wish you all the best.
We are home. Yes, home ground.
Yes, sir. I wish you, BOSA, and your entire team and Eddie BOSA, that even if you are not president, that we understand that there is this excellence here that are ready to be put into the game. If we have the right people in the match, there's no way we can't win. There's no way.
My brother, I am such a big fan, and it's an honor to be here. And
yes,
likewise. I've admired your work. I'll continue to admire it. And I just, let's get back to the intro and say, let's get those diverse groups of South Africans dancing again.
Absolutely. he loves me, but I know that his management don't, because they've been screaming for 15 minutes. We are late.
We are.
Ladies and gentlemen, representing Build One South Africa, Musi Maimane is about to leave the building. We've been coming to you from Discover TV. Check them out. We use our studios. It's a lovely setup, man. They can set it up whichever way you want. We're part of the Africa Podcast Network. Shout out to Pezulu Works for the cinematography and all of our audio courtesy of Otis the Flo Fraser and our guest, leader of Build One South Africa, Musi Maimane. creator-producer Kuvesh Mohan and the boss lady, show producer Kileto Mudisa King. Email us, waw@africapodcastnetwork.com. Till next week, have a great week in spite of yourselves.